You're listening to a podcast from the Today programme on BBC Radio 4.
Now, before the referendum, we tried to answer some of your questions and cut through the thicket of claims and counterclaims by assembling a panel of BBC editors. Well, we're doing the same again this morning, only now, of course, it's particular questions about what Brexit could mean.
And we have the same instructions as ever, brevity, because with us are people who know an awful lot. Katia Adler, our Europe editor, Norman Smith, our assistant political editor, Mark Easton, our home editor, Simon Jack, our business editor. What they know could fill the next 8 hours.
We want to ask you specifically, though, these questions. Mark, let's start off with you. Peter Gilbert wants to know, what options are available for individuals to retain EU citizenship after the UK leaves?
Okay, well, UK citizenship doesn't exist in itself, of course. You have to be a citizen of a country that's a member of the European Union, and that would then bring you all the rights and entitlements of being a member. The rules for citizenship, though, vary hugely. Ancestry can be helpful. If you've got an Italian grandfather buried somewhere or a German mother, that could be jolly useful. The rules are different across the Union. Birth, descent, marriage, or through naturalisation. These are the all possible routes to citizenship in Ireland, for instance. If you were born in Northern Ireland, that's equivalent to having been born in the South, so that makes a difference. For those without a helpful relative or a helpful birthplace, establishing residency in your chosen country is usually a prerequisite. You have to live there. But that may well become a lot more difficult, of course, once we leave the EU formally. Marrying an EU citizen or getting a job might help, but again, there are rules, as there are in the UK, for non-EU citizens, and residency doesn't lead automatically to citizenship. So outside, UK citizens will be treated exactly the same as Americans, Indians, North Koreans, and everyone else.
Katia, Miles Beale wants to know, very simple question, what happens next and in what order? And join that up with Sean Sinclair, who says we will still make payments to and uphold the rules of the EU until such time as we actually leave?
So may I now fill these next 8 hours, as you suggested? So if you have a look at the attitudes in the rest of the EU, they feel that the UK voted out and we now want to get on with it. But frustratingly for them, under EU rules, the ball is now firmly in Britain's court. The UK has to formally notify the EU that it wants to leave, and only then can divorce proceedings start. So that means untangling the UK from everything EU, and that will be hugely complex, and also starting new trade negotiations. So this formal notification process is called invoking Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty. Britain would like to hold off invoking Article 50 till it knows what a future deal with the EU could look like, and the EU wants the opposite, so it's refusing to talk until formal negotiations start. Now, in theory, until at least 2 years into ongoing formal negotiations, we remain full members of the EU with all rights, like full access to the single market, and all commitments. So that means having to continue to pay into the EU budget and accept EU migration. But this supposes no unilateral action. So, for example, if David Cameron's successor decides to ignore rulings from the European Court of Justice or block access to our labour market for EU migrants, then rules are out, gloves are off, and things could get messy.
OK, well, given that complexity, the question for you, Norman, comes from Nick Gillibrand, which is, will the next Prime Minister have the time to sort out both the issue of Brexit and manage the rest of the country's affairs?
I think the short answer is quite possibly not. Not just because of the sort of huge political intractability of withdrawing from the European Union, but in terms of the whole machinery of government. If you listen to senior civil servants, they are already warning off potential, quote, government gridlock, because the civil servants will be grappling with change that they have never dealt with before. So all the hundreds of EU laws will have to be rewritten, amended. We'll have to decide what we want to keep, what we want to get shot of. Government departments will be plunged into upheaval. Departments like the Department of Environment will no longer be handing out money through the Common Agricultural Policy. They'll have to come up with their own funding mechanisms for farmers and for fisheries. There is a sense that there simply won't be the space to come up with a, you know, significant legislative agenda. And I think the brutal truth is, because Brexit is not going to be a back-of-the-fag-packet effort, the next Prime Minister may indeed find he has very little time, energy and space to do much more politically.
Mm.
And Simon, John Rossall wants to know what it'll all cost, the exit process itself, what it'll cost the country.
Well, it's a sort of a related question in a way. Lots of ways you can look at cost. We've seen the financial markets. If you add up the FTSE 100 and the FTSE 250, which is the UK-focused one, if you add them both up, they're down about 100 billion. You can look at the cost of the economy. If we were to lose 1% of GDP, we're talking about £150 billion. But I think what you mean, John, is the administrative cost. And I asked a very senior former civil servant about this, and they reckon 20% of all Treasury man-hours and 20% of all Cabinet Office man-hours will go into this for the next 2 to 4 years, and that would be at a cost of 80 million plus 40 for the Treasury. That's £120 million per year for possibly the next 4 years. Half a billion quid.
Mark, given that there was different votes in different parts of the country coming up with different results, Fiona Patterson wants to know, how likely is it that Scotland and Northern Ireland would be able to negotiate an arrangement whereby England and Wales would leave the EU and Scotland and Northern Ireland would remain part of it?
Yeah, interesting one that. Well, it's the UK, of course, that is currently an EU member, and it will be the United Kingdom government that presses the button for the whole of the UK to withdraw. So, formally speaking, Scotland must be part of that process. They must leave along with the rest of the UK, and then in theory they could become an independent state and perhaps then apply in the normal way to become a member of the EU. Now, the UK government may seek to block any attempt to break up the United Kingdom, but the pressures on the Union, who knows how great they may be. Northern Ireland, same again, but perhaps one might imagine that they leave the UK to become part of an existing EU member, joining with the Republic. That, of course, given the history of the island of Ireland, is far from a straightforward proposition, but none of this is straightforward, to be honest. So that's the formal position, but we are in uncharted territory here. The EU, they might, given the unique situation, decide to amend their rules. They could perhaps find a way for Scotland to inherit the UK's membership. Some arrangement could be made to accommodate Northern Ireland. The point is that these are rules. They're just rules. They're not the laws of physics. And the UK might be very keen to mitigate the damage to its institution of the UK voting to leave by finding a mechanism where it loses one member and gains one or two more.
And Cassia, Lynn Shepherd has a question. I suspect on an awful lot of people's minds. Is it free movement of labour that's at issue? That's to say people with a job to go to, or free movement of people, whether they've got a job or not?
Okay, well, being part of the European single market means respecting four freedoms. So that's the free movement of money, of capital, of goods, services and people. And being part of the single market means I can apply for a job in Spain as easily as a Spaniard can. I can live in any EU country, but the welfare or the benefits I'm entitled to, that varies because that's to do with national, not EU law, as long as that law treats all EU citizens living in that country the same way. What's being discussed now, that the UK has voted to leave the EU and where immigration was such a huge issue in the campaign, is whether it will be possible to have full or close access to the single market, but at the same time not have to accept EU citizens having unlimited access to the UK and our labour market. Now, EU leaders have said a very loud no. Angela Merkel says no cherry-picking allowed in a future deal. They don't want the UK to get a quick, easy, attractive deal outside the EU that could tempt other Eurosceptic member states to leave. But we have to say, negotiations haven't started yet. This is a process of negotiation, and Brussels is known as the capital of compromise, of course.
And Norman, one for you from David Horn. Can the Scottish Parliament effectively veto any UK Parliament legislation enacting Brexit because of a requirement for a motion of legislative consent within the Scottish Parliament?
The short answer is no, categorically no. I'm not a legal, but I understand this refers to Section 29 of the Scotland Act 1998, which effectively binds the Scottish Parliament to act in a manner compatible with European law. And that would have to be amended or repealed, and the suggestion is the Scottish Parliament could say no. But actually, all they could do is withhold their consent. They couldn't veto that process. Pretty much all the constitutional experts seem to agree on that. The Scottish Parliament, the authority of the Scottish Parliament, does not override the authority of Westminster. And I noticed the other day, Alex Salmond, and the former Scotland First Minister, conceded that Nicola Sturgeon did not have that power. And to be honest, politically, I suspect if Nicola Sturgeon, you know, did try to do that, would probably, you know, reignite the Battle of Bannockburn. I just don't think it's a runner politically either.
Norman Smith, thank you very much. And also thanks to Mark Easton, Simon Jack and Katja Adler.
You can listen to more free content from the Today programme by going to www.bbc.co.uk/today.